Welcome to our final session on finding new life on the other side of loss. We're happy to have once again Dr. Jack Opperle with us to tie up any loose ends we have. Feel free to ask questions, anything that's lingering. And I just wanted everyone to know that next week we start a new series. It'll be quite different. It's one on keeping law and order in Pittsburgh. And it goes back to the beginning of the city, back to the 18th century, and it goes up to 1945. Elaine Franz, a professor of history at Kent State University, has been with us a number of times. And this is the fruit of one of her current projects. She's working on a book, and she's a dynamic speaker, so I hope everyone can come and hear her. And now, Jack, we'll welcome you to open us with prayer.
Thank you, Lettuce. Thank you, Sarah. Nice to be with you this morning. Let us begin as we are in prayer together. Let us pray. God, for the day we are grateful, its opportunities, its challenges, its comforts, its hopes, the great panoply of feelings that are a part of a day. As we share together this time, may what we say and do be helpful. May it share with us and all people a sense of promise. And in your goodness, accept our meager offering through Christ our Lord. Amen. So last time we looked at the issues dealing with the stages of grief that Anne Kubler-Ross shared with us, almost 50 years ago now. We also talked a little bit about Paul Tillich and how it was that Tillich was a person who had a real problem with death and dying and loss and the context of correlation, where he tried to give us a kind of system, if you will, by which to move through the various stages of dealing with heteronomy, where somebody else tells us what to do. And then we deal with autonomy, where we say, oh, I can handle this all by myself. And then finally, this curious concept of theonomy, which of course for Tillich as a theologian had to do with the meaning of God. But more critically, I think you have to understand that for Paul Tillich, the meaning of God was not something that was anthropomorphic. He did not feel a need to give to God personhood, and rather he understood God as being. And for Tillich, being had to do with experiencing the fullness of life in its every context and discovering issues and strengths that all the while have been inside of us. What constitutes our humanity, but likewise, simultaneously, dealing with that which comes from beyond ourselves that addresses our humanity. Today, I'd like to utilize an ancient means of teaching. It is the concept of telling the story. The telling of stories has a wide variety of functions, purposes, and possibilities. Stories have a way of sharing with us great concepts in ways that allow us to really comprehend them. When you think about the great Aesop's Fables or Pilgrim's Progress, or you think about some of the contemporary things that have been written by Harold Kushner and others, the power of a story to capture an idea and then make it ours is something I'd like to try to do today. Because I think that when we speak about death and dying, we have to remember something. Death and dying, loss, and the discovery of hope on the other side of all of those things happens in the lives of real, honest to goodness people. They're not test cases. They're not psychiatric cases. They're not even pastoral moments. They are about people who have lost a spouse, a child, a parent. They're about people who have lost a job or some sense of movement in their life. And therefore, it's important to visit the great stories of life that perhaps shed some light on the issue of loss as we, with our names and our relationships, encounter them. I'm going to share with you this morning three stories. They are all factual. Certainly, some of the material has been filtered and censored for the purposes of appropriateness. But fundamentally, these are real people, real stories, real events. The first story has to do with a man whose name is Don. Let me tell you a little bit about Don. Don spent the majority of his adult years in education. He was a school superintendent in the public arena. And in that arena, Don was always respected by his colleagues as well as the communities he served. And why was he respected? Number one, he was terribly competent. He worked hard at being the best he could be. Number two, he was also a man who was very fair. He always took the time to try to understand from where another person may be coming. Three, Don had about him a kind of innate, almost theonomy, kind of sense of support. He was the kind of a guy who, in contemporary parlance, could be referred to as a go-to guy. If you needed somebody to talk to, if you were in a difficult position, if you didn't know where to turn, Don was your man. And lastly, Don was honest. What I mean by that is he accepted what was without trying somehow to fantasize it and or deny it and or to make it more than it was. He had a wonderful sense and gift of accepting the moments of life with a high degree of integrity and honesty. Don and his wife, Constance, built a marriage that was truly a model for all of us. It was a model that perhaps had as one of its greatest lessons what a marriage does in the context of adversity. And for Don and Constance, adversity was terribly real. It was named and diagnosed. For nearly 35 years, Don and Constance faced the adversity and the ever so subtle and yet real expression of loss in their marriage. That loss was created by Constance's diagnosis of MS. At first, it began with just some weakness in the legs and the need to have an arm whenever she was walking around, going off to here or there or whatever. Dawn was always that arm. After a while, it was a cane and then it was a walker. And Dawn was always the person who made sure the locker was securely locked and that the cane was safe. After a while, all of that was replaced with a wheelchair. Anywhere they went, Constance went in her wheelchair. And for Dawn, that meant opening the trunk of the car, getting the wheelchair out, making sure it was ready to go. And then helping Constance get into the wheelchair. Their struggle, their sense of loss, their sense of adversity brought into their life and their home by MS challenged them. And yet over and over again, they rose above the challenge. They rose above the challenge in the context of very rarely ever missing a performance at Heinz Hall. They loved art, they loved music, they loved drama. And in my own eye, I can still see Dawn wheeling Connie down that aisle, getting her into that seat, and then making sure that the wheelchair was out of the way. They understood how to overcome loss. Secondly, Dawn always had a garden. The first awareness I had of Dawn was when they were living in a rural area of Washington County. And that meant that the garden was pretty extensive and the harvest was always large. And after they moved into a smaller house, as their needs changed, guess what? Dawn became the only resident in that community that had a garden. He raised fruits and vegetables, and he did it well. But here's the most important thing. Dawn always shared the harvest with all people. It was not uncommon to find a paper bag on your doorstep, and in that might be some asparagus or a few carrots. And if you ever wanted something out of the garden, it was yours unquestionably. Dawn had a successful garden, not for himself, but for his friends and his family and anyone who may come by. Here's something else about Dawn. Dawn was a father. He was a parent. And like most of us who have been privileged to serve in that role, he wasn't always perfect. Like all of us, Dawn sometimes made mistakes. But on balance, this is what we have to say about Dawn. As a father, as a parent, he was always there. He was always present for the baseball game. He was always in attendance at the concert. He stood with his children, their children, in times of challenge. For example, Dawn lost his adult son prematurely. And Dawn stepped into that vacuum, that moment of death and grieving and loss, and he cared for that widow. And he cared for those children, his grandchildren. And as the years have gone by, Dawn continues to care for those great-grandchildren who have come along. Yeah, Dawn didn't always do it right. Which one of us does? But Dawn was always there, trying to make it better. Dawn was also a fierce competitor when it came to two games. Bridge and Wizard. Now, his fierce competitive spirit wanted to win. And he did it with class. He did it with competence. He did it with persistence. But in the context of being competitive, Dawn always enjoyed a good hand or a good game. And oh, how he loved to laugh about Wizard. Dawn understood the curious relationship that always exists between competition in life. You know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to win. Likewise, he always wanted to win for the right reasons. Enjoyment, shared time, happiness. He cared for Constance during her last days of struggle. The last days of her journey were a hard place. Lots of things changed. And Dawn was there consistently for her. And just a few months before Constance died, one evening Dawn awoke from his sleep with great pain in his abdomen. He called 911. They dispatched an ambulance. He was taken to a hospital where he was diagnosed with colon cancer. Surgery addressed the problem. Dawn came home, healed, and continued on with the journey of caring for Constance in her final days. My experience with Dawn and his characteristics, his strengths, his insights, really center around two phone calls that I had. The first phone call was with a mutual friend of mine and Dawn's. And the purpose of that phone call was to share with me that Dawn's cancer was back. This time, there was no suggestion of surgery. There was only the hope and the wish for palliative care. In fact, his family said, "We're just hoping to get through the holiday." The second phone call in which I participated actually came from Dawn. And what is interesting for me about and instructive for me about this phone call is that in its course, Dawn never once mentioned his recurring illness. Instead, he talked about his family, a sense of thanksgiving for grandchildren and great-grandchildren and how exciting that all was. We talked about wonderful memories of walking in the woods together or then again playing wizard or bridge. In fact, we had a great laugh about a defunct bridge group to which we both belonged that did more talking than playing. He expressed thanksgiving for the meaning of life and for the faith that strengthens us. Our conversation ended with these words, spoken by Dawn: "Well, take care. We'll talk soon." Now, what is it that we learn from that story? Perhaps the first thing you learn is this: Dawn is and did face death exactly as he had lived. His passing through these moments of challenge and disappointment and loss and grief, in a marvelous kind of way, prepared him for all things. It was an approach to living that was inclusive. It's not always great. It was an approach to living that was always positive. Let's find a way to win. It was always caring. Take care. It was always hopeful. We'll talk soon. And so as Dawn faces his own death, he does it utilizing all of those resources that in a strange kind of way he's been practicing all of his life. The story teaches us that it really does matter how we live, how we move through all the years that are given to us, and how it is that we employ those lessons and that learning in the moments of our own loss and finality. It teaches us that when it comes to grief, death, loss, and change, it's not a matter of flipping a switch and finding a way. It's a matter of returning to and being embraced by all of the lessons and strengths and insights and experiences that we have had across our living. Oftentimes you hear these words about a person who has died. The sadness is not that they died. The sadness is how they lived. That's the first story. It's about a dear friend, Dawn, whose journey and struggle continues with bravery, compassion, hope, and also insight, lessons that he's been practicing all of his life. Here's the second story. It has to do with a little girl. That little girl, on a given Easter Sunday morning, as a member of a junior children's choir, sang a beautiful solo. She did it so well that everybody in the church commented on it. The comments ranged all the way from, that kid has a future in music, to, wasn't it wonderful to hear the innocence of her voice? That was on Sunday. On Monday morning, she got up and went to school. And that afternoon, as she was returning home and crossing a rural road, that little girl's voice was silenced forever, in that she was struck and killed by a car driven by a speeding motorist. That evening, I had the distinct privilege of sitting with her family in the midst of that horror. That evening, as we sat together, there were two grieving parents. There were siblings who didn't know what to say. There were a couple of family friends who had just come to help. And there I sat, not sure what to say, and thus remaining very, very quiet. That's my memory of that evening. It's a memory that I would call and characterize as eloquent silence. Unfortunately, that silence was broken by the front door of that home being opened. It was sort of a clumsy, awkward, noisy entrance. And the entrance was amplified by the voice of a man who was the uncle of that little girl, the brother of the little girl's mother. That man was also a preacher. He was a minister. And he felt some degree of necessity, I think, to say something. I am sure he meant to be helpful. There is no question about that. I have no way to know, other than the fact that he came there to offer something that obviously in his heart he believed might be good. The tragedy is what he offered only enhanced and intensified the pain. And beyond that, he had interrupted and broken a wonderful moment, almost a sacramental moment of silence. A silence that was sharing with people love. I suspicioned as he spoke, and later learned, that this man did not have much in terms of lived experience about death, about grieving, about loss, and about silence. His comments that he made that night in that room came from a misinformed understanding of not only silence, but also the meaning of sadness and what it is that we might think about saying or not saying in that moment. I also later learned that this man knew nothing about what it was like to lose somebody you loved, somebody who loved you, somebody who would be missed. In terms of death, grieving, loss, this man came out of an experience of bookish cliches. His words were little more than textbook definitions. Somewhere he had probably read Ann Kubler-Ross's book. And unlike her, simplistically sought to apply them. His words sounded a little bit presumptuous, and that might be too harsh. But of this, I am sure. Unfortunately, his words were not very helpful. In fact, at one point, this is what he offered. God needed another voice for his heavenly choir, and he chose Lynn. The father of that little girl stood up and asked the man to stop, and then said, "What kind of a God would do that?" What do we learn from that story? Well, perhaps we learn that sometimes it's more important to enter moments of silence by listening rather than speaking or talking. Because you see, listening offers two moments in life. Number one, it gives us the opportunity to assess where we are. What's happening here? What are the dynamics here? What are the points of vulnerability here? What is my role here? The other thing is, once that happens, it keeps us from saying hurtful, even though unintentional, bad words. It keeps us from saying and doing things that are hurtful, that create illusions and images that do not bring any kind of resolution or solace to moments of life. Oh, and here's something else listening does. It acknowledges that others may have something to say, but then again, may not have anything to say. It respects the boundaries of people who are grieving the loss of someone or something. Harold Kushner has written a wonderful book entitled When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And in that book, he lists and talks about some of the things that people offer up in good faith, but they're nevertheless not very helpful. For example, sometimes people say in moments of great grief, "This too will pass." Well, maybe this moment should not pass. Maybe it will not pass. Maybe it will always be, as Jewish theology suggests, may their memory be a blessing. Here's something else we say to each other. I understand what you're going through. Maybe not. And even if you do, is saying it more a celebration of yourself than an offering of hope to somebody else? Here's another one. This will make you stronger. Harold Kushner shares with the reader the response that he made to that bit of helpful advice whenever his 14-year-old son died. Harold Kushner responded to the words, "This will make you stronger," with these words: "Already, I am strong enough." That evening in that small little living room, the uncle broke silence, but more than that, he violated a sacrament. And we need to find ways in our own living that do not replicate that error. Silence may be helpful. It may be instructive. And to break it with something we've read somewhere or that we think is accurate and helpful may not be appropriate. That's our second story. It comes from the life of a little girl lost way too soon. A family struggling with why. An answer given prematurely and without a great deal of thought. The third story is mine. It comes from me and my experience. It has to do with what was going on for me in life when my mother died. My mother was only 57 years old when she died. She was really at the height of her involvement in life. She left grandchildren that she loved dearly, and they would always miss her. She left adult children who really were broken by this sadness. It was a season of unbelievable sorrow when, like so many others, the only things we could say were that loss had come too soon and that we didn't know quite what to say. Now, let me make a confession. I knew what to say. I knew what I should think. I knew what I should do. Because after all, I had a degree in theology. I had been to school. I had taken classes in pastoral care. I knew what to say, what to do, and what to believe. Our family was faithful. We found comfort in the Christian concepts of renewed life and resurrection. And yes, a comforting God, a benevolent God, a caring God who welcomes us home. And we were embraced by and we embraced that faith. And to some degree, it was helpful. But you know, as I struggled with knowing what to say, do, and believe, and as I struggled with my faith, I persistently searched for something that I can only call more. Because you see, the cliches weren't working. The cliche, the suffering is over, really didn't go far enough. The cliche, the pain is ended, didn't really help. There was even the faith that embraced the wonder of resurrected life seemed a bit lacking. And then it happened. One Saturday afternoon, there was a knock on our front door. As I opened the door, there stood Mark Stateman. Mark Stateman was a neighbor. He was a casual friend and acquaintance. He was someone that we waved as he drove up the lane. And he was a respected rabbi in the city of Pittsburgh. As we stood there awkwardly for just a moment, Mark Stateman took my hand and shook it and then embraced me. And he said, "I'm so sorry for your loss. I don't have much to offer." And then he spoke these words, "However, in my faith, we believe that when a friend experiences the loss of the death of a loved one, we should call that friend regularly just to ask how they're doing." There was an awkward pause again, and Mark said, "Jack, Would you mind if I called you? Think about that. Jack, would you mind? Would I interrupt your grief? Would I trespass on a place that I should not be? Would you mind if I called you? I did not immediately respond to Mark because I could not. I was so overwhelmed by what he offered me. Those words were so comforting. They embraced me with such a sense of peace. Suddenly I realized it was the more that I had been searching for in my books and in my training and even in my faith. In a strange kind of way, Mark's statement stood before me as a living embodiment of all of those realities in the life of a man so humble that he said, "Would you mind if I called you?" As the months went by, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. He called regularly. And the calls were not about what I should do or what I should believe or how I should handle something. Usually the call was, "How you doing, Jack?" Which opened up that door, you see, for me to say, "Okay," or "Not so good today," or "I'm really struggling with that." I guess some people would call that good therapy. Others might even call it good ministry. I think I want to call it good living. And I want to celebrate today how all of that came into my experience. Think about it. Notice from where the more for me came. It came from a knock on my door, a simple gesture, a knock on a door. Number two, it came as an act, not of a professional, not of somebody who knew, not who somebody had answers, but rather somebody who was a friend. Notice that it came in a simple gesture, accompanied by humility. Would you mind if I called you? I shall always be indebted to Mark's statement. And from time to time, I still wish that we had the opportunity to talk. And so those are the three stories that I have chosen to suggest this morning how it is that perhaps we could find a more in terms of how we relate to the reality of death, the reality of grieving, the reality of change, and do that with an integrity and an honesty that allows us to find hope on whatever the other side is. For Dawn, the other side is, we'll talk soon. For the other side, for the family who struggled with that grief, the other side learned to love other children and to accept the goodness that that little child brought into their lives for the short period of time she was with them. And for me, the other side is being able to remember my mother with laughter to give thanks for the years that she had and how she used them, and for the family that she instructed in ways that gave us hope. I sometimes believe and want to say that we are strengthened, or then again strengthen each other in ways that are very simple, very, very ordinary. A knock on a door, a telephone call, a friendship. There was a great medieval theologian, William of Ockham. He was a Franciscan, also a graduate of Oxford University, a New Testament kind of guy. And he had an interesting concept. It was called the razor concept. The razor concept said, universal truths, universal functions, universal responses are not really helpful because they tend to be very theoretical and they tend to operate on the concept of one size fits all. William of Ockham said, what really matters in life is the individual, the person, and the moment in which we encounter them. It is the reality of the individual that we must always focus upon as we deal with the questions of death and grieving and change and loss. Tip O'Neill, the great Speaker of the House, said it well. He once said, politics are always local. And here's the second component of William of Ockham's razor concept. He said that most times in life, the best response to the most overwhelming of questions is a simple one. We live in a strange time, have you noticed? And one of the curious things that I observe is our infatuation with something I call process. Process is what we experience on the telephone when we dial a number and we get that annoying voice that says, please pay attention, our menu has changed, and then lists seven or eight options, none of which may necessarily address your concern. Process is what I experience and what you experience with technology. You're only a click away. No, you're not. We have made life a series of processes. And when people experience death and grieving and loss and change, too often we offer them a menu of options, some of which have changed. But then again, a process that ironically defeats itself. And so it might be that the simplest gesture might be the best one, a knock on a door. May I call you? Would you mind? And then relationships that ask those simple questions. Jack, how are you doing today? I think I'm going to stop there because it's 10:30 and we're going to have some time for questions and responses at this point. So however you do that, Ted, is I'll be glad to go along with that. Is somebody out there?
If we've learned anything from the pandemic, it is that the mute button in Zoom is both a wonderful thing and a curse. You're muted is like this leitmotif that goes through Zoom meetings. And so, sorry about that. What I was saying is, if anybody online has a question or a comment, please unmute and share it. And I think we have some comments here in the chapel or questions. Here's Chip.
Yeah, a general question here, as we, at least in my sense, as we move to a more secular world, and as you're dealing with individuals who may have no faith, as we understand faith or beliefs, do you sense a different approach? I noticed a lot of yours did not have just talking and just how are you doing today does not have a religious tone to it, but just in general, as whether in your family or otherwise, as people move away from backgrounds or belief in faith and are more secular, is there a different approach that you sense is best or is coming into vogue in terms that you approach things like that, whether it be death or whether it just be depression or whatever?
I'd like to respond to that question by saying that I definitely think that it's important to realize that some of the mechanisms we have been using to address these moments of life that we've been discussing are no longer effective. I think part of that does have to do, Chip, with what you have clearly articulated, and that is great numbers of people are no longer coming out of faith backgrounds. I mean, just think about something that's joyful, marriages. Today, a great number of marriages are done in venues as ever against churches. There's no question that we're living in a much more secularized culture, and that's part of the reason for finding different ways of responding. However, I would add to that yet another thing. I sometimes think that some of the answers or some of the comments or some of the offerings that historically have come out of faith-based experience have not been particularly helpful. And for that reason, I am a strong advocate, not that anybody cares, but I am a strong advocate of making sure that when you are given the privilege to make a response to some moment in which a person is going through a very difficult time, that you give that a great deal of thought. And if you'll permit a faith reference, a prayer, so that you make the best one. And sometimes some of the things I hear coming out of religion are not always extremely helpful. Let me illustrate that. Many years ago, I was in a meeting in New York dealing with some higher education issues, and there were two men who were to be there, and they were tardy getting there. Finally, the door opened, and one of the men came in, and he apologized for being late, but he went on to say that his family had been on his telephone. He had been on the telephone with his family because their grandson was studying abroad in London, and on that day in London, in Harrods department store, the IRA had exploded a bomb, and thus they were waiting to hear from their grandson to see if he was alive and well, and he was, and everybody said, oh, thanks be to God. After a while, a second man who was tardy came in and sat down to the table, and this was his story. He had a granddaughter studying abroad in London in that same department store. Only she was not well. And you could hear, what do we say to that? And then, of course, somebody said, well, you know, God's purposes are strange. And, you know, we trotted out all that stuff. So, Chip, I quite agree that I'm instructed by your notion that we are living in a secularized culture. I understand that. And that challenges those of us who are in faith communities with what we say. But I think we should also be challenged by what we have said and be careful what the connotation is. It's like the preacher in the room that broke the silence. God needed another little voice for his choir. No. That little child was struck and killed by a vehicle that was driven by an irresponsible person. Full stop. I don't know if that gets to your question or not, but.
So, Jeff,
So Jack, I have another question, and that is, would you expand on what you said about listening? Because it occurs to me as you're talking here that in that situation where one might say, quote unquote, the wrong thing or not know what the right thing is, perhaps one option is to stop and say, I care and I want to hear more from you.
I think listening is a vastly underrated response. What I mean by that is, just think about if those words you just used were spoken to an individual who was in grief. Number one, it acknowledges them and their situation. It affirms them. It relates to them. And number two, it may encourage them to get things said that need to be said. That's the other component of listening that's so important. It comes out of the psychiatric community. And I have a dear friend to whom I'm indebted for understanding some of these things. And he's a psychiatrist. And he says that his patients fall into two broad categories. The first category is mental illness that is caused by chemical imbalance in the brain. And that is usually addressed by some degree of medication, some degree of perhaps electroshock, something that is done to the person that takes care of the deficiency in the brain. And the schizophrenia goes away, the paranoia goes away, et cetera. That's the first group. They are medically treated. The second group are people who just want to come into a space where they can have somebody listen to what they want to say. Listening. So I think that when we are dealing with each other, and when we're dealing with, whether it be in a professional relationship as a pastor or whatever, or just as a friend, I think listening affirms the value of the person and their experience, and then maybe gives them, if they wish it, the opportunity to say something. And while I'm there, whoever wrote Silence is Golden is right. In our culture, we have trouble with silence. That's why we always have the TV on. That's why we always have the car radio on. That's why we feel a need to fill up space with this too will pass. You'll get over this. You know, this will make you stronger. So that sometimes the silence in and of itself, I think, is terribly therapeutic and helpful to an individual. Medical people teach us that one of the most important experiences you can have with someone who is seriously ill is to take their hand. Say nothing. Just take their hand. Because their hearing may not be operative. They may have some cognitive issues, whatever. But there's something about the hand that in silence that is helpful.
Anyone else? Oh, here we go. Marilyn?
Yes, Jack. Your three stories were very important. I'm harking back to the phone call, how he wanted you to call. I had an experience a number of years ago with a friend whose husband died. And we talked, and I don't remember that I asked if I could call her, but I said, when I call you, what's the best time? And she said, the evenings are so lonesome. And so I did that, and respected her wishes, I thought. But I also have noticed a number of people, and not long ago, a relative said to me, well, I would call, but I don't know what to say. And I think you're talking about listening is hugely important. But I said to her, just ask how they're doing, and they will carry it from there.
How true. Thank you.
Anyone else online? John, I see your hand. John? Oh, nope, I was mistaken. Anyone else online? I'll just say, sort of as a promotion for this series, that in that conversation about the more secular world that we're living in, that I think we've had the privilege of having someone for 2 weeks who is very firmly grounded in faith, and faith can help us, I think, in ways that are unique for dealing with issues of mortality. And on the other hand, we had 2 weeks of a clinical psychologist who also brought important tools for coping with loss and grief. And I think sometimes people think about these in terms of either or, and I think both ways to look at grief and loss and mortality are very important. And so, you know, Chip, I would say, yes, to the extent that our culture is more secular, we perhaps are losing some tools for dealing with mortality. But that's not to say that the other tools that we have are not useful.
And that's part of the reason, Ted, that I chose Tillich for last week's presentation, because Paul Tillich, one of the great legacies of his life and work was to make us aware that, yes, we must always, if we come out of a faith tradition, we must always seek to find the kinds of strengths and insights and helps that that faith offers us. But he uses the word, he said, likewise, however, we must always be willing to entertain the philosophies of life, which I think is what you're referring to with the previous presenter. It's not a question of needing to choose between those. In fact, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great martyred Christian of the last century, said, we are living in a world come of age. And what that means is some of the cliches that we have historically used in the faith community just aren't applicable anymore. However, there are lots of other resources, some of which are faithful, some of which come out of the secular community, the psychiatric, the psychological communities, whatever, that are very, very helpful. And we need to be more broad-based in our understandings. Yeah, yeah.
So, Bobby?
I'm just just remembering of something I read that Barack Obama wrote, who spoke at a religious function, and he talked about this very thing of using religious language where people do not know it. So he said it's a lot more work to come up with a way to express our Christian actions and life in secular terms rather than just falling into our sort of code language. But the code language can be a turnoff to people, and they don't necessarily understand. It's more work, but it has value.
And sometimes the code language falls into the tragic category of not knowing what to say and then saying it. And I think that sometimes the faith community is guilty of that. Therefore, what Obama says about it's more difficult to find the right word, to find the most meaningful word, than it is just to fall back into the cliches. It's work. It's not simple stuff. And when you think about the privilege that you have, by whatever office or whatever means, to participate in another person's intimacy in terms of dealing with death and dying and grieving, that should mandate us to do the best job we can, and that involves work. You know, yeah.
Anyone else? Anyone online want to speak up, ask a question, make a comment? Okay, well, with that, I will thank you for two wonderful weeks, actually done on short notice. And for that, we are so grateful, and it affirms our faith that we could count on you for excellence, even on short notice. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. I apologize if I bored you or led you down the wrong path, but As my mother-in-law used to say, you did the best you could. And that's what I think that's what I would claim this morning. I did the best I could. Yeah, right.